humility and confidence and trying to say, yes, I can do that. I'm not beneath that. I can do that for you. But I'll, just so you know, I can also do these other things as well. And that eventually, however, having said that, I mean, I still, even after I've been there for years, I would go back to the sketch model shop sometimes and still work on some models, sometimes out of my own volition.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening. And once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hey everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the very first episode of Designed. I am your host, Aaron Prinz, where every week we sit down with some of the top industry leaders from within the field of architecture and architectural education, just to find out what sets these individuals apart from their peers, with the hopes that maybe somewhere you're sitting there in your studio, maybe late at night, maybe you're a recent grad trying to transition into the workforce, or maybe you're starting your own firm. I don't know. But whatever it is, there's something here for everybody, hopefully to elevate your work to the next level. In the coming weeks, we have some really exciting guests, from some really impressive firms. We got some of the principals from firms like Gensler and Page. We even have the dean of the School of Architecture from the University of Texas at Austin. So there's a lot coming up soon. So check it out, because it's going to be pretty cool. My guest today is Matt Ficus, and I'm really excited to meet with him today. I've been seeing his work around the Austin area and on social media. If you haven't taken a look at it, it's really something you should look into. mf.architecture on Instagram or Matt Ficus Architecture on Facebook. I don't really want to waste much more time because I know he's busy. So sit back, get comfortable as I read his bio here, because it might take a minute, but it is well-deserved. So here we go, everybody. Matt Ficus is an Austin-based award-winning architect and founding principal of Matt Ficus Architecture. Ficus achieved a BS in architecture from the University of Texas at Arlington before advancing on to obtain his Master's of Architecture from the world-renowned Graduate School of Design at Harvard University, while maintaining internships at some of the leading architecture firms across the country, including Julie Snow Architects and Brinkley Sargent Architects, just to name a couple. After successfully completing his degree from the GSD in 2005, Ficus joined the Pritzker Prize-winning firm Foster & Partners in London before branching off in 2010 to form his own design firm, Matt Ficus Architects, in his hometown of Austin, Texas. His work has garnered him national recognition by the American Institute of Architects by being featured in the AIA National Emerging Professional Exhibit in Washington, D.C. in 2012, 2014, and 2015. In addition to his work in the studio, Ficus is also a tenured associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin, where he specializes in teaching courses in sustainable design technologies, community involvement, and is currently the director of the Graduate Program of Sustainable Design. His work within the University of Texas system earned him the 2013 Regent Outstanding Teacher Award, the highest teaching honor awarded by the University of Texas system. Ficus has also been a visiting instructor and guest critic at some of the world's top architecture programs, including Harvard University Graduate School of Design, the ESA in Paris, France, and the University of Lund Technical School of Architecture in Sweden, just to name a few. In just over 7 years, Ficus's work has been featured in a number of national publications, including Dwell Magazine's Top 20 Homes of 2017, The Wall Street Journal, and most recently co-authored the book Architectural Science in the Sun, The Science of Phenomenology in Solar Design. In 2015, he was named the AIA Austin Under 40 Award winner, and in 2017, Ficus received the AIA Austin Emerging Professional Honors Award. Also in 2017, Austin Business Journal declared him, quote, Matt Ficus solidifies himself a local icon. Please welcome my guest, Matt Ficus.
Thanks, Aaron.
That is one hell of a Tinder profile. Wow, we got a lot to cover. So I think you keep winning these emerging professional awards. I think you've emerged by now, haven't you?
Well, it's a funny question because my team has joked with me a lot about that. Say, what does it mean to have emerged? And we've joked, what does that mean now? What defines the emerging category is if it's within 10 years of being licensed, you're eligible in the emerging category. And so that raises the question of what's the next group? Are you now the submerging group after you've been around for 10 years now among all the submerging architects? And so this notion of emerging is interesting. I appreciate the intent of those types of recognition because architecture is typically an old man's sport. And it takes a very long time to get any recognition in this field. And so the idea of the emerging recognitions is to note achievement by young architects, because otherwise young architects have a very long process before establishing themselves, whether it means establishing your own firm or even building something of note. It takes quite a long time. And so that the whole emerging idea I appreciate in principle, but I also realize that it sounds funny. But I just recently passed the 10-year mark of having been licensed, and so I'm technically no longer eligible for most emerging recognitions.
Well, I think you have an interesting part of your story that I think a lot of people will maybe sort of relate to, is that for me myself, I went to Portland State University, is where I did my undergrad at, and thought of, say, a school like Harvard or going to work for Norman Foster. That's, for a lot of people, I could see where coming from that sort of environment, that's kind of like a pie in the sky. It's like Narnia, like it exists, but like no one actually goes there. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So you started at University of Texas Arlington, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say is not a traditional feeder school for Harvard. Am I correct?
Well, interestingly, it actually is a the School of Architecture does send, or I shouldn't say send, but I would say there are a few schools that tend to have graduates that go to the GSD, including the University of Virginia, University of Florida, to name a couple, University of Washington, Seattle. There are a few that tend to have a few folks that go, and UT Arlington happens to be one of those. And so it does sound obscure, but the GSD almost pre-approves certain schools that they recognize for advanced, and when I'm referring to that is for advanced placement, which is the equivalent of coming in with a background in architecture. And so there actually was some precedent of UT Arlington grads going to the GSD. However, despite that, it was very much what you described as this mythical place that still seemed like a wild long shot. And when embarking upon the undergrad degree, which in architecture, any degree in architecture, but especially the undergrad degree, is a grind. And at the beginning of it, to even imagine going on to grad school is hard to fathom, much less going on somewhere like the GSD.
Well, can you put us in that space? So you show up your first year, Arlington.
Sure.
Are you the standout student, or what's the, put us in the studio there, and what did you do at, in Arlington that really made you kind of a force to be reckoned with, I'd say?
That's a good question. The first year, I would say there was, it became clear to me, and maybe this is true for a lot of people, when I started architecture, I didn't know much about what architecture was when I started the undergrad degree. And maybe I thought I knew about 5% of what architecture was going in just from observing the world around me, and realized that I knew less than 1%. And after my undergrad degree, I thought maybe I know 5% now about what architecture is about. So upon arrival, my first sense was just a very humbling sense of realizing how broad of a world architecture was, from practice to theory. And I feel that a lot of the first year of architecture is breaking down your preconceptions of what you think architecture is. So, for example, you don't use the word windows typically. We talk about fenestration or glazing. Because when you say window, you automatically assume some preconceived notion of what that should look like. Likewise, we use the word threshold instead of talking about a door. So a lot of that first year for me was very much about, oh, wow, I realized actually I have a lot to learn. And it was clear that I had a long way to go, but I also realized that I really enjoyed it, that there was something about it that resonated with me. And so despite the rigor, despite the intensity of work, there was something about it where I realized I could swim, I can do this. Go ahead.
I think you're obviously established, more established now, but if that's your thought process of like, oh, I know 5% of this, at least coming out of school, I think there's like certain types of kids that appear in architecture school. There's the kids that are going to get a degree and then they're going to go do something else. Then there's the kids that really talk a lot, but always can never find inspiration or whatever it is for their project. And then there's the people that really are there all night and still come out thinking they know more than 5%. So I think you were incredibly aware, I'm going to go out on a limb and say your place in the field, you were aware of it.
That's probably a fair assumption. And as such, I worked incredibly hard. Realizing that I wasn't going to be able to just show up and go through the motions. I had to really invest myself to get anything out of this and to make progress. And so I think it is fair to say that that sense of awareness was important. And I would say as a general principle, one of the more critical components of being a good architect or a good architecture student is having a balance of confidence and humility. So on one end of the spectrum, if you're overconfident and you're arrogant and you think you have nothing to learn, you know it all, you can't be taught, nothing to learn, you'll never grow then. You're dead as a designer, actually. You'll never ever, you've peaked, you'll never ever get better if you think you know it all and that you can't possibly get better. That's no good. The other end of the spectrum is complete insecurity, to where you stare at a blank page and are afraid to do anything because whatever you do might be criticized, might be wrong. And that can be crippling as well. And you won't grow that way either if you're not bold enough to take a chance. And so I think there is a fine line to walk in terms of having just enough confidence to put something down and explore something, research, propose something, yet also be able to step back and receive criticism and feedback on that and understand that what you did has some merit, but certainly can be improved. And so I would say that that's been a thread that's been gone all the way through my academic professional career I had some sense of awareness of that early on that stuck with me.
Going into, so once you get accepted to Harvard, you show up. Can you take us through the first day in that studio? Is it ultra competitive? Because I always feel like when you start a new school, everyone sort of has they're all nervous, but everyone sort of wants to have kind of a chip on their shoulder to some extent. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine Harvard is a place that would facilitate that sort of mentality.
When I first arrived at Harvard, it was clear that everyone there was exceptional. It was clear that it was an all-star team. And everyone there had been the very best from their undergrad program, which at face value was daunting. And one might imagine that would lead to even hyper-competitiveness, because since everyone had been competitive enough to be on top of their class to get in, you might expect that. However, I found it to mostly not be the case for two reasons. The first reason was the fact that it's such a magnet school, and the fact that everyone came from somewhere else. No one had really a home field advantage. Everyone felt as though, I don't know anyone in this place. I'm vulnerable here. I don't have any connections. And as a result, everyone sort of needed each other as a support group, and no one had a circle of friends there at all, and so it was a bit of vulnerability in that respect. But the second layer that's probably even more important is that they don't give grades. It's pass or fail. And so as a result, there's not that competition for the 1A that's given out in studio, which would have been lethal, I think, in that environment where everyone's used to getting an A. Everyone did get probably mostly straight A's from their undergrad program coming in. And if you put it into an environment there, to have that pressure off of it's pass, fail, and knowing that if you apply yourself, you should pass, that took the pressure off. And everyone was self-motivated enough. They didn't need it. It wasn't as though people would mail it in and say, well, I don't, I'm just going to pass. I'll just show up. People were driven, but then they just decided how much you want to drive yourself and in what ways. But it wasn't a matter of trying to beat out others. It was deciding how to work with others and to collaborate and to build on each other's strengths. And so one of the things that I got a lot out of the program was the fact that people came in with a lot of different skills, and people were willing to share those skills. And so, for example, I had very strong drawing skills and physical modeling skills. I could graphically produce that was my strong suit. Presentation skills were my weakest link. And there were others that were the opposite. There were others that had come in perhaps with a background of something besides architecture, and they could present exquisitely, and their presentations were phenomenal, but they didn't have the skills to draw to back it up. And so we complemented each other very well and learned from each other and would critique each other on those two things and say, I would be able to explain, here are the fundamentals of drawing to someone like that, and they'd be able to explain to me, here are the fundamentals of presentation and logic and how you think through explaining a concept of a project. And so despite what you might have guessed, despite what I would have guessed as well, I thought when I showed up, I imagined to be a shark tank and everyone to be out after each other. I realized pretty quickly that we were all in it together. It was all a collective effort. And I've since, even that was 16 years ago that I started, and I still am in touch with almost everyone in my class. Many of them have visited here in Austin. I've visited others at their offices around the world.
Are most of them in their own firms now, or are they?
It's a big variety. I'd say most are working for other firms, but a fair amount, not quite half, but a fair amount have their own firms now. And so, for example, one of my classmates, Jeffrey Von Oyen, he worked for Frank Gehry's office for 10 years after finishing grad school and launched his own firm. And just by chance, Architect Magazine had a little feature that featured the both of us. And just coincidentally, it featured two projects that we had done side by side for his own firm and my own firm now. And so while he was at Gehry's office, I was at Foster's in London. Sort of very, you know, sort of parallel lives. But it all came back to that first year of all of us arriving there and not knowing what to expect and developing a lot of camaraderie throughout that process. And that is one of the most valuable things to me of grad school. Yes, the professors were fantastic. The classes were fantastic. But the relationships and connections, not in the business sense connections, just the camaraderie and the conversations, the discussions, was priceless. I learned so much from my classmates.
It's really interesting. So while you're there, can you take us through maybe some of the projects you worked on there, and what do you think the quality from your undergrad to the grad, can you kind of bridge what that is in terms of what your projects were, what was expected of you, and if you were to go back to Arlington with what you knew leaving Harvard, what might you possibly implement?
It's a good question. The undergrad experience for me was much more about formal composition than it was about concept and theory. And as such, you know, that when those were the terms that were set before us, that's what those are the skills that I developed. That's what I pushed myself, and that was my target, was to learn to craft things formally and represent them visually very well. The depth of concept and theory behind them was not great, just due to the terms of the way that the school approached. And it was at the GSD, it's not that it was the opposite, it's just that now the theory and concept were as important as the formal aspect, and you couldn't have one without the other. So that's the biggest and overarching difference. But in terms of the projects themselves, I would say there was some similarity in terms of, for example, in both undergrad and grad school, I had housing projects that we approached, and both we had large public urban buildings we had approached for studio. In grad school, there was a little more latitude in terms of research and exploratory work for kind of hypothetical projects. And that was one difference that made a big difference with me. And so I would say that the instructors at the GSD, their own work and research spills over into the work that they teach, which makes some sense. So as opposed to having a coordinated curriculum where every program of each studio is prescribed from the administration, instead the instructors bring their own agenda. And as a result, that led to things all across the board. And in one particular case, I had Atelier Bow Wow, so Yoshi Tsukamoto and Mamayo Kajima, from Tokyo would fly in every 2 weeks as our instructors, and their project was quite abstract. The program and description was so vague that it led to a dozen completely different projects in the studio on a dozen completely different sites, because they were just interested in flux, this notion of fluidity and movement. So how do you understand how movement works in a city and design something that influences movement in a positive way? That was really the program, which never would have been the case in an undergrad degree to have something that open-ended. So the fundamentals were more or less the same, but then there were a few opportunities where things were a lot more exploratory, and that was what I needed. I needed to be brought out of my comfort zone to where I couldn't go back to, well, give me the program and I'll extrude something up from that program. Instead, I had to step back.
That's a lot of the criticism I think I get in my design, is that they say like, oh, you know how to put together a building, but we need to really elevate it into something, which I think is probably a common thing of kids that have an undergraduate degree.
That's right.
Coming into grad school. You touched on something when you were talking about your buddy that worked for Frank Gehry. So you went on to work for Foster and Partners. Frank Gehry. So I think by attending kind of a high-class university, even University of Texas Austin, which is a solid program, we're afforded certain level of networking, I want to say, than some other schools would, and Harvard, I'm sure, is even more so. So can you kind of speak a little bit to that in terms of how you ended up with Norman Foster? What were kind of your other options, and why did you end up there?
When I was entering my final year of grad school, and my thesis advisor was Rafael Maneo, the way that the thesis works at the GSD, you have a choice to overlap. I'll back up just a moment to explain the thesis. The thesis exists of one semester of thesis research, and one semester of thesis execution. And you can overlap that thesis research semester with your final design studio semester, or you can then punt it later, and which is called splitting, and you're effectively going one more semester and to have a freestanding research and thesis semesters back to back. And when I was going into my final year, I wasn't sure how I might pace it. I had previously had a studio with Rick Joy as an instructor, and so I had a job offer with Rick Joy, and I thought about going to work for Rick Joy for an internship, and I also had an offer, I believe, at Kengo Kuma's office, and I was talking to Frank Gehry's office as well. I was considering those.
That's a rough batch you got to choose from, right?
Well, and a lot of it has to do with these sort of connections that are there. And before I continue, I'll just mention that the thing about connections for me is it's not political. It's not purely political at all. It has to do with just giving the opportunity to prove yourself or not. So it's just a connection alone won't get you anything. But the connection with a strong portfolio, for example, can open doors. And the way that happened was I was interested in living in London. I thought it would be an interesting experience to go live in London. And among all firms in London, and probably all firms in the world, I was most impressed with Foster and Partners. I just by chance happened to learn through a mutual friend that there was a GSD graduate who had graduated 5 or 10 years before me who was working at Foster's, and I was given his email address. And so I just sent him a cold email and just said, you of course don't know me. I am a GSD student, finishing up my degree, and I'd love to have an opportunity to work with you all at some point. And he said,
I can imagine a lot of people might think that's kind of an intimidating thing to do.
It was intimidating. And he replied right away and said, go ahead and send me a portfolio and I'll put it in front of a partner. I said, yes, he said, I'm a GSD grad. He's been working here 5 or 10 years. If you send a portfolio, he first said, this is what I mean about the connections only taking you so far. He said, send me a portfolio. And I sent him over a portfolio, and he said, okay, I'm willing to show this in front of a partner if you modify this in a couple of ways. He said, this is a good portfolio, but what we really need is someone who can build physical models and someone who can sketch very well, which were things that I was very confident in. I just didn't happen to have in that version of my portfolio. And so I included those things, and he said, okay, this is a solid portfolio. I will go ahead and show this to a partner. So that's an example where the connection got my foot in the door, but if I hadn't had an impressive portfolio in his eyes, it would have ended there. And he would have said, sorry, thanks, well, but no thanks.
And so, I think it's also really interesting that kids in school, I feel like, and I'm just making assumptions here, mm-hmm. but get really wrapped up into the Rhino, Revit, 3D, digital this, digital that. But the things that got you your job there were hand sketching and building physical models, which I think if you still look at, like, we're sitting here in your office, I can probably see from where we're sitting right now, there's probably 100 models, which I feel like a lot of firms, they will, as soon as you're out of school, you ditch all of this stuff and you just, like, it's like you forgot everything that you spent thousands of dollars earning, right?
No, you're right. It's easy to fall victim and fall prey to this notion of just working with the latest and greatest software and becoming defined by whatever the latest technology is. That's a trap, I think, actually, for students and recent graduates, is to become known as that person's really good at rendering, that person's a Revit whiz, or that person's whatever. And my undergrad degree was all analog. Everything was done by hand. And then my graduate degree was all done digitally by default, meaning that instructors and the way the students mostly all worked, everything was digital in grad school. And I brought hand things to the table just because I was interested in that. But I feel very fortunate to be on that cusp of seeing the transition from analog to digital. In my first job in the late 90s for Max Levy, there wasn't even a computer in the office. It was just completely all done by hand. And it wasn't not even a computer for word processing and email. It was just we drew everything with the straight edge.
Sent letters by hand. Courier pigeon and did all
that. That's right. And so that was exceptional. I mean, he was exceptional anyway, but that even that's changed for him since then, well, due to my presence in the office, actually. But the point there being that you're right that analog methods of sketching and physical models often go by the wayside in a lot of professional practices and for the convenience of whatever the latest software is. And so one of the things I took away from working for Max Levy while in undergrad and also while working at Foster's in London was just the value of the physical model in the sketch. You can't replace the immediacy of the sketch. It doesn't matter how good someone is at 3D modeling. If you can't sketch something like the back of a napkin type of sketch to convey an idea to a teammate, to someone internal on your team, or to someone else, even a diagram to show it's about this relationship here. If you can't do that, if you have to then go to the computer to pull something out, it's lost. It's absolutely important to be able to have enough confidence to sketch something. It doesn't mean it has to be a picturesque sketch. It has to be a clear sketch that communicates something that you can't do otherwise. The same thing with a physical model. There's something about a physical model that can convey information in a way that no other medium can, in my opinion. And at Foster's, the first at least 3 months, they only put me in the physical model room. I was just making physical models. However, that sounds very limiting, perhaps. But
yeah, how'd you work your way out of the model shop?
But in fact, it was in some ways a privileged position. It was a good way for me to start because the powers that be, the senior partners at the firm, were very interested in talking about the latest physical models. They wanted to, because that was where the design was really happening. It was happening with the study models that were being made. And sometimes in one project, I made 75 options throughout the course of weeks. And I would...
Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
So you start out a project, models 1 through 5. You're kicking, right?
Yeah.
15 to 20, the light has to be going on like, how many more of these do they need? Number 65... What's going through your head? Sorry. Well, you know, it's like you start a road trip and you're like, this isn't bad. And then like 4 hours later, you're like, oh my God.
No, there's certainly a certain amount of perseverance within any complex. And this was a skyscraper, a million square foot skyscraper. And there were a lot of variables that came into play. And it was a lesson to me about how complex something can be, how many variables there can be. And there were plenty of points where I thought, you know, at some point we're going to go full circle. And we're going to come back to what we started with. But what it allowed me was a chance to talk to the senior people in the firm, the senior principals, the senior partners, about what the designs I was proposing. I was proposing original designs there. I wasn't building presentation models. There's a separate model shop for that of 20 people that are not architects that just build presentation models for clients. This was an internal process. So I was designing by hand. Whereas if you've been there 3 to 5 years, you're then working exclusively in drawings, mostly in details, and Norman Foster and then the senior partners usually don't care to talk about the construction document set as much. So you know you don't get to talk to the senior designers as much when you're in that kind of middle phase. And so it was great for me to develop a relationship with some of the folks that really were the movers and shakers of the firm and those that led the design reviews, that led the design vision of the firm, and to talk to them firsthand, to tell me what was good about what I was doing and what was not good or what was not in line with their agendas, with their visions for overall and for that specific project. It actually was very good for me to start there. But in order to break out of that, what I had to do to answer your question, which was partly tongue-in-cheek, I realized that the burden, the curse of doing that really well was that I could end up only doing that for a very long time. And so I just spent a little bit of extra time, worked some overtime, going back into the office and starting to work on helping out with drawings and on the same project team for which I was building the models for, helping out with a few of the drawings, helping out with renderings, and establishing my ability to work on different fronts to where then I started getting called back into the office more often.
So you'd put in your 40 hours in the model shop and then you'd stay extra hours to go in and work on details or drawings or whatever it may be.
That's right.
How many hours on top of your time?
You know, it wasn't an insane amount. It was just enough to be tangible. I would say probably an extra 5 to 10 hours a week or so. And of course, it fluctuated. Sometimes it didn't. The team didn't need help, and there was nothing more for me to do. Other times, there was a pressing deadline, and absolutely, you can help on this drawing, and absolutely, you can do this rendering. But that was generally the idea: is that I put in my full time job of my assigned tasks. I spent the 40 hours a week on that, and then said, what else can I do? Partly because I just want to learn other things as well, but also prove that I had skills and to be able to draw and represent things in ways besides physical models. So I was trying to straddle that line, as I was saying, of confidence and of humility and confidence, and trying to say, yes, I can do that. I'm not beneath that. I can do that for you. But just so you know, I can also do these other things as well. And that eventually it led. But however, having said that, I mean, I still, even after I've been there for years, I would go back to the sketch model shop sometimes and still work on some models, sometimes out of my own volition, just because I wanted to build something I knew that would make a difference at the meeting. And I was there designing real time, but now just, you know, again, by hand. So it wasn't something that I saw as you graduate from and now you never have to go back, which is why we have physical models all around you, as you're describing, because for me, it isn't something that's beneath me or beneath our office. It's something that's a tool that's as valuable as digital representation, but just in a different way.
I think you make an interesting point talking about not what's beneath you, but the sort of humbleness that you've carried throughout your career. Just numbers-wise, out of the amount of applications that Harvard receives, how many people do you think get that acceptance letter?
I was told that in the program that I applied to, there are several different types of programs, but the program that I applied to, that 1 out of 25% were accepted to that program.
And out of all the applications that Boston Partners receives, how many of those applications, what percentage do you think turn into a job offer?
I don't have stats on that, but
fraction of a percent, maybe?
Probably. I would guess less than 5%. I don't know if it's a fraction of a percent, but probably less than 5%.
So
my guess would be.
What do you think it is now? You've obviously been through this whole process about yourself, and you've kind of touched on it here and there, that really just kind of made you stand out.
I think that at each step of the way, whether it was in my undergrad degree, even to get the job for Max Levy, each step of the way, I was willing to go the extra step and go over and beyond what was asked of me. And it doesn't mean that it had to be a radical amount over, but I had this sort of inquisitiveness and this interest, this curiosity to go beyond whatever the bare minimum was in general, and it's sort of a thirst. And so, I don't think I've ever thought about it quite this holistically as well, all at once. But when my first job offer came out of impressing one of my early design studio instructors, so when Max Levy, who in my mind is the best architect in Dallas, when he called UT Arlington and asked my professor, who was then the dean, said, "Who's the best student? I want to hire an intern. Who's your best student?" And my name came to mind for that professor because I just, partly by luck and timing, had happened to be in his studio. But while I was in his studio, I would not only try to do good quality work, but always would go over and beyond in terms what was asked of me. And actually, he emailed me. That studio with him was more than 20 years ago. And I heard from him in an email in the last week. And he reminded me, he said, "I remember when I gave the assignments to the students and I had all the students ask them to design one model. He said, you had three and each of them were better than all the other students. But the fact that you had three alone was so clear how much you just had this passion of constantly getting better. You clearly demonstrated that there was enough humility there that you always knew there was room to improve." And so I think it was that, it was, yes, there's certainly some talent and skill involved in that, but I think that talent can only get you so far, and as much as then you develop that talent and push it. And so when I think of that, getting that very first job to work for Max Levy, which ended up being for 4 years total, it came from just going a bit over and beyond in that design studio. And then when I think of, and then getting into the GSD was similar in that respect, in terms of when it comes to getting letters of recommendation, when it comes to having a portfolio. Something has to stand out, and just going through the motions wouldn't have done it for my undergrad portfolio or for my recommendations or for my statement letter. Each of those things were just a bit beyond. And then likewise, going to Foster's, needing to have a portfolio that would stand out even among a typical Ivy League portfolio, it needed to stand out. And so, and then even applying for the teaching position at UT, even the average Foster employee, every single step of the way, it seems as though there's been certainly some fortune. I've been fortuitous along the way, but part of that luck is just created by, you create those opportunities by constantly impressing everyone around you. And what that, a part of what that means is just being a good team player, like being someone that others want to work with, that you make other people better when you work with them. And that's actually one of the things I would say about when it comes to job interviews. I think that and I actually learned this later than later along the way. But I used to think that a job interview was all about impressing someone with the quality of your work, and I think that was more the case in an analog era. You would show up with the portfolio, and no one could have ever seen your work before because there was nothing to see online and nothing to email. You show up with a physical portfolio, and so much of your interview would be about showing your work, selling your work. In the past decade, it's much easier to see someone's work digitally and remotely. So by the time you bring in someone for an interview, you've decided that they're talented. You've decided that you're impressed with some of the skills that they have. The reason you bring someone for the interview is largely to get a sense of if you want to work with that person. Is this someone that you think will be a good fit? Is this someone that you want to work with? And so that's when you get a sense of that balance of humility and confidence. Where does this person stand? Is this person so sure of themselves that they're unteachable and that's the problem? Or is this person so insecure that they're never going to ask a question because they're too insecure? And so a lot of it comes. So I
can
learned
you tell all that way. From an interview? Because I know a lot of the
affectation that people put on during interviews can not necessarily be a realistic personality.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's never completely sure. I will say that most people that I've hired have been multiple interviews and or former students. I'd say 75% of my current team are former students.
Do you have an issue of... I want to get on to your firm here. But
sure.
So you have a pretty good gig going, Foster's. Why would you leave? What's the thought process? And coming from there, you can probably go to any city you want, any large firm here in the United States. You come back to Austin, Texas in 2010,
mm-hmm.
which Austin at the time, I mean, it's grown a lot since then. It's on its way up, but still not the city that it is today. Why Austin? And can you take us through those? What was your office like at that time? What type of projects were you working on? Did you have projects? What was that whole process? And what made you have the gall to leave, I guess?
It's a good question. I think as a precursor to the transition, the 2008-2009 recession was it just ripped through the entire world of architecture. So when I started at Foster's in 2004, there were 400 people in the London office, and by 2007 there were 1,000 people in the London office, and in the 2008-2009 recession it went back down to about 600. And those numbers, I'm rounding it roughly, but it led to massive layoffs. And it's impossible to describe the feeling the day that happened, when hundreds of people were let go at once. And in my case, literally the person sitting to the left of me, the person sitting to the right of me on my project team were cut. And I survived the layoff. I survived that cut. Work actually got much more difficult after that. The cut was seemingly deeper than it maybe should have been. They maybe lay off more than they should have. And I'll hasten to say that being on the other side of that now, being on the leadership side of a firm, I understand how difficult it is to staff. It's very difficult to know how many people you should have based on how many projects you have. So I don't point any fingers anywhere. But regardless, my workload went extremely up. Which I didn't mind to a certain extent. I was working on a very exciting project for the Smithsonian Museum of African American History.
Heard of it.
We were shortlisted. We were shortlisted among, you know, with Diller and Scofidio and Ian Pei and Antoine Predock and David Adjaye and Moshe Safdie. And David Adjaye ended up winning that competition. But I was working on that competition, and I liked the project, and I liked the team I was working on. But we were just understaffed. Our team, we didn't have, we were only three of us that were producing on that project, a 350,000 square foot building. And we had to get it to effectively schematic design in in months. And so it was a combination of that wear and tear of working on a very difficult project without enough firepower and enough team for us, which took a toll on our team, in conjunction with the fact that I had started teaching in Sweden a little bit. I started teaching in Lund, Sweden, which you had mentioned in the beginning. And so I really enjoyed the balance of teaching and practice. And however, working full-time as an employee at a firm didn't afford that, didn't afford much of a balance. I was able to dabble in teaching here and there and get away for little excursions to teach workshops. It was a combination of realizing, well, I've been at Foster's for 4 or 5 years and had gotten a lot out of it. It had really been an amazing experience. But there were a couple of life decisions that had to happen around that time that have to do with me being a legal alien in England. So one of them was my work permit was going to expire. I had a 5-year work permit at which then I can either go through the process to become a legal resident, or then I can go through the process to become a British citizen. I could become a dual citizen effectively. And both of those required a bit of effort and work and were just an investment to do that. And you only want to go through that if you really were planning on staying longer than the 5 years. So it was a combination of sort of thinking, all right, I'm reaching this precipice of I'm now kind of beyond sort of my special work visa, my work permit to be there, which was a convenient time to sort of start thinking what the next step might be, if I do continue or not. The other thing was it became clear to me that the progression from there was going to be moving up in management in the firm, which had pros and cons. And as I thought about it more and in a firm that large, I realized I was less interested in moving up the ladder within the firm. And it was not to do with that firm itself, not to do with the specific people at all. It was just to do with the sheer size of a firm with many hundreds of people. There are so many layers of management that I had learned the majority of what I was going to learn in terms of design and caliber of work and that sort of thing. And now I was going to be learning more about management. I felt as though that was the next step for me, which was interesting in some ways. But as I stepped back, I thought, you know, I really would like to find a way where I could practice and teach. And there aren't many places. Well, for one thing, it's very hard to do that in Europe for reasons I won't go into, to do with how the structures work, and not to mention all the work permit hurdles and other things to describe as well. But so I thought, you know, maybe I could come back to the U.S. now, and it'd be great if I could find a way that I could practice and teach. And there just aren't too many places in the U.S. that afford that opportunity. And apart from the coasts, and even it's not even because it's on the coast, but apart from the coast, if you think about most schools of architecture, even if we talk about Texas A&M or Texas Tech or UT Arlington or both schools in Oklahoma, working your way up, you think about where most schools of architecture are, there's not a place to really practice as an architect. And Austin was one of the exceptions. It was clear that Austin was a place where there was just enough industry and just enough of a market to practice. There's also a very good school of architecture. And on top of that, my parents lived in Texas, and I've been away from Texas for 15 years at this point. So my parents live in South Austin. It's a good school and a good city and a possible chance to practice. And that was a perfect storm for me. And on top of that, speaking about my grad school classmates in that network, the reason I heard about the position was one of my grad school classmates happened to be teaching at UT at the time and notified me that there was going to be an opening for a tenure track teaching position.
Mm-hmm. That
Liam O'Brien is his name. He's since moved to MIT. He's now tenured at MIT. He's actually coming to lecture at UT as a guest lecturer soon. But Liam mentioned that, you know, there was a position opening up, and he said it had to do with building technology and sustainability. It had to do with what he understood my focus was at Foster and Partners, and knew that I was getting into teaching. I figured it was a long shot to get that role, as I didn't have much experience teaching at the time. But threw my hat in the ring and managed to get shortlisted. Even when I got shortlisted, and so I was one of the three or five interviewees. That was already a victory for me. I thought I'm getting a paid trip back to Austin to see my family and go for the interview. But anyway, but coming back to that question, I was in London and I'd had a great run at Foster's. I really enjoyed the city at London, the city of London, and I'd also enjoyed teaching a bit. And I just had a moment to step back and think about what the next step might be, and I was interested in the idea. I seriously considered the idea of staying there for another 5 years or 10 years or going on. But I thought maybe this will prove out, maybe I'll try to apply for this teaching position at UT. And if that works out, I might pursue that. And if I don't get it, I don't get it. And then I stay.
So if you don't get the job at UT Austin, possibly you're not here. Is that what I'm understanding?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't have come here. I wouldn't have come back to Austin without a job prospect lined up. I didn't have, I don't have that. That's an example of not having that much confidence. I wouldn't have just landed this and hope it'll just work out. That's not my mentality. I'm very calculated and I plan things out. There was actually one other scenario, which was if we had won the competition for the Smithsonian Museum, I was supposed to go to DC and set up the Foster site office for the next 3 years to finish up the design and the next 3 years for construction. So there was another scenario there. So there were kind of two binary things. One was, do we win the competition or not win the competition? And it all unfolded in the same week where we found that we didn't win the competition. It's like, okay, I'm not moving to DC. So now it's down to London or Austin. And then I got hired in Austin and said, okay, I'm going to make the move. So I was not going to move to Austin unless I had that teaching position lined up. So otherwise, then I would have been in the same boat. Even if I had had a job position lined up in Austin, I would have been working again full-time for a firm and maybe teaching a little bit inside. And so I wanted to have the opportunity to teach and then decide when and how to launch into practice.
So with your practice, so you're here in Austin, you're teaching, you have your firm. Is it just you and your house? Do you actually have an office? What's the office like? And can you take us through a time maybe early on where you're sitting there and the phone's not ringing? And what do you do to get past that? And how do you think that that's benefited you in the long run?
Yeah. In the beginning, I told myself that the first year I would just dedicate to teaching. I said, this first year, I'm going to make sure I can just stabilize, get my feet on the ground. And because if I don't get that right, then the rest might not matter. If the teaching job falls apart and my teaching salary falls apart, then it's not even worth thinking about the rest potentially. So I decided that my game plan was just to focus on teaching for the first year. And during that first year, I had three projects pop up. So, and that speaks a bit to a lot of the most of the existence of my practice as a sole practitioner, as a firm leader. I've been very opportunistic. I have a hard time saying no to any opportunity that pops up. So I had three potential projects pop up, and I took on each of them, and I was just working out of
this is the build one model, and you end up building three.
That's right. That's it was a bit like that. And yeah, if nothing, I'm an optimist. And so I took on those three, and I would say that happened about somewhere in the middle of 2010. So about, you know, my first 6 months here, that started to pick up. And within a year, I realized I couldn't do it on my own. I realized that I couldn't teach full time and do the other service responsibilities I had for committees and the writing and research I needed to do and do all the production. So I realized I needed to hire help. So it was in early 2011, I then hired two assistants. To recent UT grads to help me. And we were just at the time squatting in coffee shops and in the materials lab at UT, you know, when they would have us, and then later squatting in the office of another firm. It still didn't really feel like we were a firm. We felt like we had a couple projects we're doing freelance together is what it felt like. To answer that second part of your question about, you know, is there a moment when the phone didn't ring, and there were probably been a few make or break moments, but the most distinct one was in the summer of 2012, where we had finished up a lot of the first batch of projects that we had taken on. They were winding down, and we clearly needed new projects at that time for me to keep my two employees. I had two employees and I had a couple of interns that were working intermittently part-time, but two main employees that were fantastic and I really wanted to keep on board. I didn't see them as hired guns. I saw them as people that I wanted to be part of a team with and was going to be very sad if I lost them. So as a result, I decided to bleed for a while and keep paying them even though we didn't have work for a while. And
so every week it's just money out the door.
Right. And it was so what we were just doing
to build
was just,
models just to keep them busy.
Yeah, or? Working on design competitions, working on the few projects that we did have that were even finishing, then doing extra drawings that weren't billable for that work to document the work and extra renderings.
Were they aware that this was case?
And part of the from the very beginning, my firm's been quite transparent, quite open book with everything, and part of that's out of necessity, because since I'm teaching full time, then in order to be able to, I just couldn't be in charge and on top of all of the financial components. I had to have help with that as well, and so they were as familiar, if not even more, having their finger on the pulse of exactly how much money we have left than I was, and so. We got to a point where I had kind of gone through most of my life savings at this point, where it seemed as though this could be the end in the summer of 2012. And we realized we were probably within a month of crashing. And we were all very aware of this, and I was very honest with them about this, like, I'll help you find jobs other places if nothing happens. And In 1 week, we landed 3 big projects that month, and it went from famine to feast. Suddenly we were understaffed, and so it was literally the day before we were overstaffed. We didn't have enough projects for our staff, and then suddenly, like, how are we going to deliver on it? That's fantastic that we got these 3 projects. How are we going to deliver these projects? And so it was a new challenge to have now, to have actually far too much work even for our small team. And we realized we needed to start growing. And so that was probably the most discreet, clear, the clearest moment where it felt as though we felt incredibly vulnerable, and realizing that it could have gone one of 2 directions. And that's one of the moments I'll think back on often when there's any stress to do with any current projects that we have. And one way I find gratitude is to remember that it's much worse to not have projects than to have projects that are stressful or that have any problem at all. Like, the worst problem is to not have a project. And so I often draw from that and remember that moment when we were starving, literally, and then we're inundated with work again. And that's somewhat of a pattern throughout time. I think in the architectural field, it's very hard to pace your work out. But that was one of the more extreme dips, and then just an incredible resurrection from it.
Awesome story. And I think maybe this will lead in, because there's a recent student's assistance or something that or have so much responsibility in your firm. I think if you look at your firm, how many employees do you have now? 15, 16?
15 employees now.
15. So they're really young. They, in the grand scheme of architecture, I think you talked about this earlier, but on paper, they might not look like you have maybe the experience of some of the larger firms just based off a number of years service or whatever. But you guys are still killing it, winning awards, being in publication. How is it that you have such a young staff and you're still able to perform at such a high level? And I don't mean that in a negative connotation. I hope it didn't come off that way.
No, that's fine. I think that there's an interesting sort of curve that comes with our profession. Like, when we think of a learning curve, for example, as I had mentioned earlier, Our profession is typically geared towards, it's older and male. The AIA recently said that the average AIA member is a 52-year-old white male. And it's not shocking when I hear that. It's like, that makes sense. That's average. That means there are a lot that are much older than that. If the average is 52, then there's a lot that are older. And I think that there's a part of the way that we've gotten to where we've gotten is a very specific attitude of that just it relates to optimism, but has to do with seeing challenges as opportunities. And so, we took on projects that other firms weren't interested in taking on. We took on projects that, so for example, there was a lot in South Austin with a large oak tree right in the center of it, which hadn't been developed for a very long time. It seemed like that was going to be a big pain to work around this lot that was protected by the city, by the tree ordinance. It was going to be hard for an architecture firm to do what they would typically want to do. And we saw that when we got hired for that job. It was because we went in saying, we're actually excited by that challenge. Like, how can we'll find a way to do something that fits the bill functionally and that also aesthetically pleasing as well. And that attitude, that optimism, and when you do that once, you can make a little bit of a ripple, and it might still seem like it's a fluke. And if you do it again, and then after we did it maybe 10 times, then people realized the value of that perseverance. And especially in a city like Austin, where the ordinances and regulations and codes are quite strict, and the permitting processes can be very painful in Austin. And a lot of our projects were born out of that, where people came to us with a very difficult problem to solve, saying these other firms don't want to bother with it. Would you guys take this on? We're in a floodplain. We have this other overlay here. We're not sure what we can do. There's some other deed restriction. We have to go through the Historic Landmark Commission. And it's, yeah, we'll get through all of it. And we're going to make it work. And sometimes we weren't sure how we were going to make it work, but we were confident we could do it. We were confident that the collaborative, the sort of the collective intelligence of our group, that we could find our way through, in addition to having a lot of talent on the team. And that's what helped to catapult us forward, was by proving ourselves and cutting our teeth on some very, what was seen by others as being very difficult projects that others wouldn't touch, that we embraced. And I think that really made a big difference in terms of allowing us to then be awarded larger projects by others that had projects that were now more desirable projects to even established architects, but had appreciated the rigor of our office. So there are many other ways I could try to explain it, but that's one of the biggest ways, to just do with this certain amount of optimism, this sort of can-do attitude that we bring to every project that I think, or we like to think, is appealing to certain people, to have this sort of youthful energy that we're going to really make this really good, instead of going through the motions and just handing off another product that looks just like your brand of typical project. And so that's part of it as well, is the fact that no two of our projects look alike. Every one of our projects is a one-off. It's unique. It's driven by the site, driven by the client, all the unique conditions that have to do with it. And I think that also helped to elevate us as well, because people felt as though if they hired us, they were really going to get something unique and they weren't going to get something off the shelf.
The personal service, the quality.
The service, that's right, that's right.
Customer service?
I can't emphasize that enough. We actually describe ourselves as a service provider. That's first and foremost, we're a service provider. As opposed to an artiste who goes off in the laboratory and in the studio and crafts your thing and crafts your masterpiece and then hands it off. That's absolutely not what we are. And that's what has elevated us, I like to think, is the fact that we are first and foremost there to provide a service, and part of that is listening a lot to what the client needs. Like, what is it you really need? What are your main goals? What are your priorities here? And then coming back with a couple of options and saying, this is our interpretation of what we think you want. And I'll explain the pros and cons of these two different schemes that we're proposing here. But we want to hear your feedback on that, and we're here as a service to help deliver which one you want. But that's absolutely a huge part of what we do, and we'll often say that probably less than a quarter of our work on any project is the actual drawing of the project. Much more than that has to do with the coordination, whether it has to do with the coordination to go through with contractors, with consultants, with permitting, overseeing construction. There's so much to do that is not seen. Even though in a typical drawing set we'll have 300 to 400 drawings, that's still not the bulk of our work on a project. So yes, the service is a huge part of it. And most of our clients are not professional clients, meaning they haven't gone through the process of hiring an architect before. And they lean heavily upon trusting the architect and counting the architect to hold their hand and guide them through the entire process. They want that service. That's part of what our kind of youthful energy brings to this, is saying, you know, we're on top of this. We're going to be there for everything you need. We're going to be there to explain all of this to you, because it will be overwhelming. We guarantee it will be overwhelming. And that's also maybe relates and overlaps a bit over to the academic strand of the office as well, this notion of, so the idea of being a professor, the idea of wanting to teach people along the way, to explain, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, just so you understand that's how this fits into a larger network of decisions that we're making. And we'll later zoom into another thing, and we'll even describe this as kind of homework assignments for our clients. We need you to go home. We need you to think about these things and make decisions on these things. We need you to research these things. this is your homework assignment. We think about it very much as a way of educating people, and in doing so, providing a service that goes beyond just creating a drawing or a scheme or a form that might superficially be interesting or look good. That's not why we're hired. That's not, in our mind, that's not being a good architect. It's just drawing a good design, developing a good design. It's about contextualizing it and explaining it, providing that service of carrying that through and getting it through construction, making it work.
Okay, before I let you go here, I just want to finish up here, a little word association, so I'll throw out a word or a phrase and maybe just whatever comes to your mind, either it could be a word, story, something, just whatever comes to mind, okay? So sustainability and architecture.
For me, sustainability at its root is taking the word literally. What does it mean to sustain? What does it mean to design something to last? I think that's something that gets lost a lot. I think that sustainability can have a lot of associations. People might think of solar panels or recycled materials or any one thing. But it's really about thinking about this larger system of things that have to do with enduring. How does it become part of a larger system? How does it become something more than itself? How is it part of a closed loop system? And if you keep zooming out to the earth or beyond, how does it play a role in that? So it's a long answer for that one, but that's my thought of sustainability.
Pritzker Prize winning architect Raphael Moneo.
I think the best reaction with Moneo is, if I had to say one word, it would be depth. That just, there's a certain richness to the way that he thinks and designs that really appeals to me, that I find utterly unique, to be honest. For one thing, he is part academic, part practitioner, which is already fairly unique. There aren't countless numbers of architects that balance those two things equally well. Usually you choose a camp and you're more of an academic, you're more of a practitioner. There are very few of us that try to straddle the middle, as it's very difficult. And he's one that does that very well. And so I would say if there were maybe two words, sort of balance and depth. But when it comes to this notion of sustainability, he would be one that I would think of that you wouldn't think of as being a sustainable architect due to a lot of the connotations that come with that word. But he is, in the sense of designing things that are timeless. He designs things that I think will be relevant many generations from now, which is as important to sustainability as any one material is or any other gadget that is an application.
The GSD.
The GSD is very interesting in the sense that part of the reason I chose the GSD was due to the variety of offerings that it has. So it has a variety, everything from the instructors themselves, the students themselves. There is not a single prototype of a GSD student or a GSD professor, which was exactly what appealed to me, like, as opposed to a school like the SciArc, at SciArc, for example, which I respect a lot. But the difference at SciArc is that it was very clear that there is a certain aesthetic and a certain brand that they're very good at and everyone falls in line with, and the faculty and students. For my graduate school experience, I wanted something, that reflects a little bit more of my undergrad. What SciArc was is what my undergrad was, a formal-driven school. The GSD is not formal-driven. It's very much about theory and concept with the form then being balanced with that.
Norman Foster.
Norman Foster, he's a legend. It's very hard to explain. It's very hard to summarize Foster in a phrase or a sentence or even one book. He embodies a certain sense of ingenuity. He embodies a level of ingenuity that most architects don't. In other words, a lot of the way that he thinks about architecture is, how can we expand its boundaries? How can we think? How can our design logic lead to something else? How can architects play a role in things larger and smaller than buildings? And as such, he's, I would say, the single biggest force as an architect in the world, because he doesn't fit a typical paradigm of what an architect does. So he is interested in engineering as much as he is in architecture. He's interested in product design as much as he is in architecture. And all of those things lace through all of the firm, which it sometimes can make it difficult to understand what your place is within the firm. It's such a large firm and there are so many moving parts. But that's part of the point. Part of the point is it shouldn't be just one predictable thing that you boil down the firm to, and it's, oh, it's a one-liner. It's the firm that does that one thing. It's a firm that embodies exploration, that embodies inclusiveness, and just a pursuit of making the world a better place through design, which sounds like a platitude, but it's really meant. Norman Foster really means that, and he really believes that he can make the world better through design, and I think is overall.
The University of Texas at Austin.
I think that UT, you know, in a lot of ways, the way that I describe the GSD in terms of variety, really UT at large is so campus-wide. There's so much breadth. It's so many unique and interesting things happening within each of the schools, each of the departments, that it's very hard to pinpoint what UT, what its one thing is. It certainly has a lot of things going on as well. But I would say that UT has a good balance between tradition and innovation as a university at large. And then I would also say within the School of Architecture, I would say it's a similar thing. There are core fundamentals that lace through a lot of the teaching of the curriculum in the School of Architecture while also having a healthy dose of experimentalism. And that's what appealed to me about wanting to be a part of the program when I decided to join the faculty. I appreciate the fact that there were faculty members, some that were a bit more conservative in their design thinking, a little bit more traditional, and some that were very forward-thinking. And I think that's important for a school to have that variety of pursuit, and then allowing the students to balance their diet in terms of choosing who to work with along the way. And so it's a UT at large really has that balance, this sense of their institutional weight and presence, at the same time with a strong investment in trying to forge progress as well.
Your proudest moment in architecture?
That's a good question. One of the proudest moments in architecture was to see my first building built. It's in general, the most fun part of any process is when you get the light bulb, whether that happens individually, usually it happens in a team, in a brainstorm or a charrette, and you sort of have this idea, this is what the project is about. That's it. We've got it. And you know that the rest will happen from there. We have that kernel of an idea that will generate the whole project. So that, as a general rule, is the most exciting part for me in practice and in teaching. However, the very first time of seeing something built that you designed is especially rewarding. And also, also you learn a lot of lessons from that as well. You realize it looks so good in the drawing. And it looks not quite like that in built form. And sometimes there's happy surprise. Like there's a happy surprise where you realize that looks better than I thought it was going to look. And that looks worse than I thought it was going to look. And it's a lesson that you can't ever learn any other way than when you see something built. And then you understand, going into your next design exercise, what things to pay attention to, and you begin to understand things like what a specifications document is for. Well, that's why we have these rules for materials and methods. That's why we have this. So that was a very proud moment, seeing the first thing built. And at the same time, it was also very humbling as well to understand that there's a big difference between how we represent things in 2D quite often and our understanding of things in 2D and as opposed to how they actually come out experientially.
Your biggest setback in architecture, and how did you use it to further your career?
The biggest setback was I was laid off by Max Levy in the 2001 dot-com bubble, when that bubble burst, sort of a post 9/11 recession that happened. And it had gone from this incredible fortune of being hired by, as I said, who I think is the best architect in Dallas, and having the privilege to work with him for a couple of years. And I was the only employee working for him. It was a one-man show, and me. And it all boiled down to we were working on one project, a big project, and to the point where all our eggs were in one basket on that one project, and that one project didn't go forward, and so that my job ended all in one day when our project ended, and there was nothing else for me, and I knew it, and Max knew it, and had to let me go, and it was especially tough because that was across the board, no architecture firms were hiring, maybe not all were laying off, but certainly none were hiring, and so that was a low point for me where I felt as though I had done the best that I could do in undergrad and applied myself and finished with a strong portfolio and has worked for the best firm in town and didn't have a job at all. And I think it was about 100 days, you know, about 3 months or so that I didn't have a job and was just working on, you know, building out my portfolio and redrawing certain things, just doing a few design exercises. And I was also teaching tennis pros. I had played college tennis in undergrad. It was a low moment, but what I learned from it was to never take a job for granted again. And not that I took that job for granted overall. I just had a renewed sense of appreciation for any job I would ever get from that time on. And I decided, as stressful as anything gets, I will never complain about having my job. Or whatever my job is, I'm not going to complain about it. Because I know it's far worse to not have a job. And so it ended up instilling a certain sense of just a certain fire in me of I just want to give me another chance. I want another chance to prove myself, and I'll prove that I'm invaluable to any firm that that ever hires me again, or to any client. Now on this side, as an architect running a firm, I'll do the same thing for each client. Just give us a chance, just hire us, and we'll prove to you that you made the right decision, and you'll never want to fire us.
Last question. What advice would you have for the freshmen sitting in their studio all night, just making model after model, thinking it's never going to end, and you know, hopes to have a career like you've had? What advice would you have?
I think the most important thing is to be very honest with yourself about how much you fit into the profession, or vice versa. In other words, it can be a very rewarding profession, and can also be a very trying and very demanding profession and career path. But it's important that you have a deep passion, and that there's some part of you that really enjoy the process. It doesn't mean you enjoy every moment of the process. There certainly are frustrations that come along with it. But it's important to be sure that you're satisfied in some deeper way by the work that you're doing. And if you're not, there's no shame in changing and getting out and getting to a different major. So what I'm trying to say basically is to be decisive, whether it is those late nights or whether it's just long hours or even just a tough review. Having a tough review that really challenges your confidence is, don't let any of those things get you down, as long as there's a part of you that finds it satisfying, finds the whole part. It's almost as though you can't imagine yourself doing something else. And as long as you have that feeling, persevere and go through it, and it continually gets better, and there are rewards on the other end. But by no means does it get completely easier. there's always, at least from my experience, there's always been somewhat of a struggle along the way. It's never been smooth sailing, but I think that's part of being in a creative field, is that there's a certain amount of uncertainty that comes with any creative pursuit. In other words, if it were completely formulaic, if you knew what you were going to do for your work for the rest of your career, then you're not actually creative at all. You're not actually designing. Part of designing is being suspended in some doubt and exploring in some uncharted waters and not being sure where it's going to go, but enjoying that pursuit. And I mean, an analogy of that would be on a road trip, where you have a destination on your road trip. But if you're only interested in the destination and not interested in the trip itself, it might not be worth taking that trip. If there's something could go wrong or whatever, it's like you have to be willing to kind of enjoy the journey along the way. And so this is a long answer to that question, but I think that there are a lot of challenges that come with pursuing a degree in architecture and then pursuing a career in architecture. But all of it's worth it if there is just an embedded passion, and if that journey is fun. And you hope that never completely goes away. You hope that there's this sense of exploration and learning and a sense of growth all the time. And so I would say that in those times, it's important to step back a little bit sometimes and not let yourself get so overwhelmed that it's not life or death. Those late nights and those tough reviews, they'll come and go. That will pass. That will be gone. But if throughout it, if you are learning something, if you're gaining something, if you're growing in some way, then it'll all be worth it. It's all worth it in the end. It all finds a way to redeem itself. But it is absolutely a journey. And there's never a point, or at least at the very beginning of this talk, we talked about this notion of emerging. There isn't a moment, a moment of arrival, I don't think, completely to where you think, as I've said, where you think, oh, now I know it all. I've arrived. Put it in cruise control. I hope that I don't reach that point. I won't reach that point where I thought I've peaked. This is it. I hope that instead I feel like I'm a student of architecture all along. And part of being a student is that humility while having the confidence to keep going further.
Matt Ficus, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down. This was amazing. Hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you
so much, man.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.